I'm Emily Theed, author of This Vicious Grace, coming in summer 2022 from Wednesday Books.
And I'm Anna, a teacher and a writer in the Queery Trenches.
And you're listening to Basic Pitches, where we...
Two basic pitches.
Break down the basics of writing and being a writer. So here's my banter.
I'm ready for banter.
Oh, this is not a secret. Hey-o! Look, there's something that's not a secret. Actually, it was funny because I found out that I was tagged on Instagram and I went to a thing and I discovered a thing and I was like, but I did not know about this thing. And then like the next day I got the email about it. But my book is going to be in this the box called Fox and Wit. I don't know if you've heard of it.
I haven't.
Well, it's a subscription box. I think it's a new one. And the part that I am trying to figure out now is they asked for a playlist.
Ooh.
And this is really fun, except I can't listen to music while I write because otherwise I start typing the words that I'm listening to.
Uh-huh.
So I'm one of the rare writers that doesn't really have a playlist because basically, like, if I have time to listen to the music, then I should be writing. And if I'm writing, then I can't listen to the music.
Right.
And I have small children, so I don't get to listen to music all that often. So
right.
I obviously know music, but I'm not, like, so on top of things that I have, like, playlists ready. But so anyway, so today I went on a deep dive on Spotify and remembered why I don't write to playlists aside from that, which is because I'm so, so easily influenced by music when I'm listening to it that it shifts my whole mood. And then I'm like, I don't know, like I get why people write with playlists, but it's almost dangerous for me because if I don't pick the playlist right, I'm going to write an entirely different book.
Right.
But I was just thinking of all the brilliant people out there that are so good at making playlists and just bowing down to them because
you know you have to have that new band. Well, I don't know if they're new, but they're relatively new that everybody's obsessed with, and I didn't know everybody was obsessed with them, and I was like, who are these people? I love them so much.
Gonna need more information.
Right, ready? They are an Italian, like, indie rock. It's Måneskin. Uh-huh. Or whatever.
Oh, yeah. Oh, that's the one song I had. Yeah,
I heard
Begging.
Them the other day, and I was like, does Emily know about these people?
I do. I have two of their songs on my playlist because Begging, the first time I heard that one, I was like, what? Excuse me? What? Were Hands?
Their
what?
Version of that. Ugh.
Is incredible. But so they also have another one, and I'm forgetting what it is, but it's in all Italian. But I was like looking at the lyrics, and I was like, this is perfect. So, yeah, there's going to be a lot of Italian on this playlist. So people are going to be like, I don't know any of these bands, but it'll be fun. Yeah.
Oh, man. I'm excited.
And if anyone has read an arc of my book and has ideas, please send them to me.
You'll have fan playlists.
Like, oh, okay. Yeah.
That's how I operate now is, like, I'm outlining this new idea, which I'm doing the almost V.E. Schwab style outline where it's, like, almost 10K now.
Nice.
But it's mostly just thoughts to myself where it's like, I want her to do this, but this doesn't add up. How do I get there? No. And I'm talking to myself. But a big part of it is finding music to, like, suit what I have in mind. And really, like, it'll make something click that's dramatic enough. Like, I'm a super melodramatic writer. And
as we all should be.
Right? As we all should be. And if there is a scene that I'm like, the scene isn't popping, I usually have to go find a song that fits the scene. And then that kind of generates some ideas for that scene. And
Well, I was thinking, I was like, and again, maybe this is obvious to everyone that makes playlists all the time, but I was like, they should be in order, right? Like, they should be in order of, like, I was like, is that not? Like, because that was my first thought, was like, oh, yeah, this song would be perfect for this part of the book. And then I was like, oh, no, wait, now I have to put them all in order. And I was like, basically, I'm rewriting my book using songs. And
I think some people maybe.
Yeah.
I think Stephanie Garber does hers, and I think hers are in order. She has them in, like, this should be this chapter or whatever.
Yeah.
There's, like, an official follow along on their website, or somebody else's, where, you know, if you're listening to the playlist, this is for this moment and this is for this moment.
Yeah. Because that was my first thought, I think, is when I was trying to pick songs, I, you know, immediately was like, oh, yeah, like this lyric reminds me of this part of the book. So then I was like, I gotta put them all in order.
Yes.
And so there I was basically making, like, a beat sheet out of music when I was like, Emily, you need to write your sequel.
Right.
Like,
focus on your sequel. I think it was Hannah Witten.
Probably. Hannah's really good at this
stuff. I think she did an annotated copy of For the Wolf, in which at the top she wrote down the song.
Oh, that's so fun.
Title that went with it. Like, the song that
maybe
went with
it. Maybe if I get this
really
playlist
fun.
Done before, I was going to do an annotated arc giveaway if I get around to it before my book comes out. So maybe if I get this playlist figured out, I can do that.
That'll be fun. That's cool. My, like, that's kind of my goal, is to go through and if I ever get there. That's like author goals for me, is to be able to write, here's the song that goes with this, and then here's the moment and the lyrics that kind of like inspired it or like influenced it somehow. I think
that would be really fun. Yeah, that would be really cool. Yeah, I wish I have ever read an annotated book. It's another thing I realized. I was like, I'm going to annotate this arc. And I was like, what do people write when they annotate an arc? I've never actually seen one.
The episode I just did with Lily Lanoff. Mm-hmm. So that episode I just did with her, she talks about how she annotated it. And every time sword or stab was mentioned, she just made a count. And she was like, oh, this is stab number 37. This is sword number 75. Like, so it was really on point for her.
I love that. Like, I have some things, but I was like, I just don't know if it's like, do people write stuff on every page or just like every once in a while? Like, I don't, like, it's just the sort of thing that you don't realize you don't know it until suddenly you're sitting down with a pen and you're like,
that's what I would do. For me, I would just reread it, and then anything that pops in my brain that obviously I want somebody else to know or copy on the internet, I would just write down. Like, you know, I would definitely do the little, like, whenever there's, like, a little innuendo joke, I would be like, hee-hee.
Yeah. There's a lot of those.
Right.
Yeah. But yeah, so that'll be fun. So that's my next to-do once I've,
That's made a cool few. For a box. What a good idea.
Yeah, I thought that was really fun. I thought that was really cool. So, good times. And I'm also living in a weird space now where I keep hearing from people that have listened to my audiobook, which is really exciting, but I have not listened to it yet. So I'm like, how is it? Do you like it? Is it good?
Right.
So, yeah, publishing timelines are strange.
Yeah.
So I'm in a very, like, audio space right now. I'm like, audio. I'm like, audio book, audio songs, playlists. Like, yeah.
Publishing timelines are the strangest. And
they are.
I'm over this querying thing.
Yeah. Understandable. It is the worst.
Yeah. In case – I know we have a bunch of querying writers who listen as well. If you're querying right now and you're like, is this normal? The answer is no. It is the most abnormal querying set, like, time I have ever seen in my entire life. I think Lauren Spieler put it on Twitter. She was like, there's somebody, she did the AMA thing that she does all the time. And it was, somebody asked, like, is now not a good time to query? Because I've heard it's so slow. And she was like, never is a good time to query. Like, you know, it's not, you know, we're never not busy. So just go ahead and send that query. So for anybody who's like querying or thinking about querying, I mean, just go ahead and do it. Just know that if you hear nothing, it's okay. Like, this is the one time where no news is good news. And it'll probably take 30. Like, people who have those rapid response rates don't have those anymore. Like, they don't have them. It's gone.
Yeah, I think that there's a big difference between, like, trying to choose when to query versus, like, querying whenever you're ready, but then, like, adjusting your mindset as much as you can to accommodate whatever's happening out there.
I think that's the biggest thing. Like, I've done this a while, and, like, this is the weirdest I've ever seen it. This is the weirdest I have ever seen it. I don't understand the rules and, like, the rules and etiquettes that applied 5 months ago do not apply right now. The rules and etiquette that applied a year ago definitely do not apply anymore. Like, the thing of response rates, if anybody's telling you response rates percentages from even 5 months ago, throw that in the trash can. It doesn't apply right now.
Yeah, I feel like those are the things. It was always like, never put them in writing, because as soon as you put them in writing, they're going to change, because publishing is so transitive. And I think too, you know, we're coming out of a very weird phase for the world, and so I think probably agents and editors and everyone in publishing is just kind of like trying to figure out the new normal, and things are falling by the wayside.
Yeah, and I think that's the other thing too, is as much as you can, I don't know, I'm not prescriptive with my advice, but my advice to anybody right now is to stay away from the negative vibes that are going around on Twitter. Like, stop. There's people who, like, yell at agents or get really snarky about agents just doing their job, and that just makes me really uncomfortable. Never helps. And, like, it makes me upset for the person who is saying it, as well as the agents that they're talking about, because it doesn't help anybody. Like, that doesn't help anyone. It's okay. It sucks. Go cry in a Discord. Go cry with your friends. Yeah. but don't air that dirty laundry on Twitter. I don't know. Yeah. Just be careful. Yeah, with it how doesn't. You protect
yourself. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, find the healthiest release valve you can. Right. Ideally, a less public one.
Right.
Is a good publishing rule in general. I think because right. you never know when something's gonna sucker punch you or right. just kind of like. Fall apart unexpectedly. And I think one of the hardest things about this industry is that we are all so tuned in. We have this sort of community in a way that like probably other industries don't like chat about random stuff on Twitter the same way that yeah. authors do. But it can kind of trick people into thinking that they can be as casual publicly as they might want to. And if the goal is to have a career in this industry, then like it's, you know, important to find a balance where you can be kind of honest and open, but also keep some right. things where you won't regret
right. seeing them. Because if you see, like, I mean, I'm the first one to say that I made a tweet that did okay. It got more attention than 5 people, which is weird for me. but it was about how, like, querying is broken. And I said mm-hmm. it. I was like, this is broken. It is a broken system. You know, and that's not to knock any agents who say querying works, because it does work, but it doesn't mean that it's not broken. And
yeah, it's not efficient at all.
Exactly. And I think like the way I based that tweet was not to call querying out or call the industry out. It was to say, to just draw that attention of this is broken. Can we fix this? You know, how can we make this worthwhile for everyone involved? How can we make this work for every single person who tries to get their book published? What is there to do about this? And then also as a way of like self-care for people, like it's yeah. broken. It's not you. It's the machine. It's the
machine. Totally. Yeah. It's Gosh. Rough stuff.
You know, it's
publishing.
You know, yeah. it's not rough stuff.
What is not rough stuff?
The fact that this is our first Q&A episode.
Yeah.
Woo!
Thank you to everyone for having questions.
Thanks for wanting us to answer and talk about this stuff and go down totally. Rabbit trails, because
that's what we do.
It's gonna be big. It's gonna be it's gonna that's be an episode how we have. Of that.
Brain bunnies.
So Emily, I have a bunch of questions here that
Easter.
I've gotten from.
Sorry.
Look at you.
We're recording this the day after Easter. So
I love
brain
this.
Bunnies.
Yay, brain. Oh, I'm gonna call them brain bunnies now. because it's rabbit trails. Oh Jesus.
Yeah.
I just made rabbit that connection trails. In my brain. Hi. What's up? So, Emily, I have a bunch of questions here from people on Instagram. I will go Woo-hoo. In order. Ready? Here we go.
All right. Let's do it.
Lisa on Instagram asks.
Hi, Lisa.
Hi, Lisa. Lisa's an amazing human being. I actually know her. How do you balance the art and business of writing? And then they further clarified the muse with being commercial enough. So how do we balance art and business when we're writing? How do we balance being commercial but following where our heart leads us?
Yeah. Do you have thoughts?
Yeah, actually. I do, because this outline of this book is totally different for me. And mm-hmm. it is the first time that when I am drafting, I am letting myself go. Like I'm just letting myself create this outline. I'm getting lost in asking myself questions about this world that I have and these characters I have. I'm allowing myself to ask the question, what if, a whole bunch. And you know what? If I told, like, I've told a couple people the premise and they are like, this is like, you know, there's like this thing of like, huh, this is amazing. Like they have a really good response, and like whether they're being nice to me or they really believe it.
Yeah.
The concept is buck wild. Like it is buck wild in a buck wild setting. And I think what has clicked for me is that if it is fun for me to write and I take all the tools that I have as a writer, I can make it commercial enough. So I can look at something and say, you know, this doesn't fit in this market right now, or this doesn't fit, period. Like this probably will never sell the way it is. I'm not interested in writing it that way. I want to write a book that sells, so then I can find things that like don't belong. And then I can mm-hmm. weed them out. And maybe they belong somewhere else in a different iteration and a different story. But for this one, they don't work. Yeah. I don't know if that really answers the question.
I think that transitions actually perfectly to what I was going to say, too, which is that I think sometimes we act like the, you know, artistic side and the commercial side, or even the literary side and the commercial side, are like polar opposites. And I really don't think that's true. The way I tend to think of it now is that commercial comes down to sort of the packaging and the marketing of something. And sometimes stylistically as well. Heart of a story, in my opinion, doesn't necessarily have to be one or the other. You know, when I started writing This Vicious Grace, I wasn't writing it to try to be commercial, because I thought I had been writing things that were commercial, and then I kept being told that, you know, I was a good writer, but they couldn't sell it. And so I was just like, whatever, I'm just going to write this thing that I want to. And the more invested I got in it emotionally, the more invested I got in trying to figure out how to make it commercial, because I wanted other people to read it. And I think when I think of commercial, one of the first things I think of is whether it has a hook, which for the longest time I did not understand. Yep. And then for a long time after that, I thought a hook meant like had to be something that was almost baked into the story. Whereas now I often think of it as like there are lots of different things that can be hooks. And the way you use a hook is, one, it's anything that can catch a reader's interest. The more hooks you have, the better to catch more readers' interest. And I think that most books, especially if you're really excited to write it, have hooks, even if you haven't figured out what they are yet. When yes. I started writing this book, it was supposed to be a dark fantasy. And in the end, I think one of the biggest hooks is the romance and the humor in it, which I didn't know were going to be there at first. But once I found those, then I kind of used, okay, the combination of this sort of dark premise with this unexpected, perhaps, romantic vibe. And like that, yeah. I think, is the hook that gets people interested. So yeah, I would say if you're writing something you're excited about, one, think about what it is you're excited about, because that's probably a hook, because it's a hook for you.
Right.
And I think when you look at, like, five people could read the same book and describe it five different ways.
Uh-huh.
And a lot of times what I've realized, like, what agents do so well is finding the hooks and figuring out how to pitch a book in a way that makes it sound interesting or different or unique. But there are so many books, like when we do our Pitch Your Book Badly, it's very easy for a book to sound like it's not commercial if you don't describe it the right way. And yeah. There are lots of ways to make a book sound commercial if you describe it the right way. You're just – commercial is trying to figure out what appeals to it, what appeals to lots of people about what you wrote, and making sure they know what that is.
Yeah. You glitched out there for a second, but I think I caught the gist of the end there.
Okay.
But no. I think that's exactly it, is that I think thinking commercial – helps at all stages when you're working on something new, especially. I think it helps to kind of keep in mind, like, not what the market is right now, because if you're writing to the market, you're already 5 years too late. Like, you're late. You're too late. Goodbye. Not really. I'm just kidding. But if you're writing to the market, you're probably a little late. You should probably just think more of commercial as this broad umbrella, like you said, of things that are, you know, things that people will love. My mentor during Pitch Wars put it as, she had her pitch the year that she was in Pitch Wars. And the one thing that they kept turning, people got excited about, was the best friends to enemies, or whatever, lovers to enemies. And mm-hmm. It was lovers to enemies. And she was like, people really attached onto that. And that right there is the commercial hook, right? Mm-hmm. That's something that people will always want. And then I think it is also something a little less generic. Emily Taylor talked to me about it one time about starting a project, because I asked her, like, how did you get to this point with this, like, new thing that she's working on? And I was like, how do you do this? Like, how do you come out the gate with this beautiful pitch at me? And you don't even know what happens in the story, like, what's going on? And she said, you need to find something that people latch onto. So try a bunch mm-hmm. of pitches out on people and see what they latch onto, what gets them excited. Or, you know, if they kind of have a, oh, that's really cool response, go back and workshop it some more. Go find something else that's like a little more hooky, right? Like, I think the thing that people attach onto with the current project I have right now is Magical Gold Rush.
Mm.
And that's like, you know, that's kind of a little new and interesting. Magic itself is not new and interesting. Magical rocks are not new and interesting. But if you say Magical Gold Rush, I think that changes things for people a little bit. They start to ask questions like, ooh, how does that look? How does that work? What's the setting with that? Ooh, if that's the setting, then, you know, you got to find that little – that thing that is hooky. And then that's the sellable thing that you mentioned that's so smart.
The question part, too, I think is – not all, you know, some hooks can be as simple as enemies to lovers romance or a cool setting or whatever. But some of the most effective, like, pitch hooks are often a combination of something people are familiar with and something that they don't know how it fits with that first thing, because it makes you ask questions. Yes. And one of the best ways to get someone interested in a story is to present them with questions. So when you combine, like, you know, two random, like a random book with a random movie premise, you know, you say Little Women meets Star Wars. Your first question is, how do they meet? Right? And that in and of itself is already a hook. The hook is the question. How do those two things go together? How is this author going to put those things together? I think when you're writing a book, you know, chase the things you love and then figure out, well, how would you convince someone to read this book? That's the commercial element. And then I think there's an extra step that comes in when you are revising it. You know, once you've had your fun and you've chased your joy and you've written that draft, it is what you love, and that's great. So you have one reader hooked. But to get more readers, there is a moment there where, again, to be commercial, you can stop and ask yourself, okay, well, what is the best way to make sure that, you know, I hook readers and I get them invested and I keep them invested? And that often comes down to lots of things, like there's commercial pacing versus literary pacing, which, again, I don't think they have to be the opposite, because literary can come down to lots of things. But commercial pacing tends to be pretty fast paced. It tends to mean that you're having a lot of tension. And one thing I discovered, we were talking about this earlier with Killing Your Darlings. I realized the other day, someone said, how do you know when you have to kill your darlings? And I had a moment of realization where I realized I generally don't kill my darlings. Right. Because when I have a bit of dialogue or a moment in a book that I love so much that it's a darling, I will move heaven and earth to keep it in that book. And a lot of times I think that's the step, that's the revision step, where you're going from, okay, this is a perfectly fine book, let's make it more commercial, is like, okay, well, you need to trim this dialogue because it's too long, or you need to make this more active or whatever. And that's when I do lots of things. Like, I will take, you know, fun bantery dialogue that doesn't necessarily move the plot forward, but it's really enjoyable. Yeah. And at the moment, it's just two people sitting in a room, and I'm like, I already have that scene. So I take that dialogue and I'll work it into, you know, a fight scene or a training montage or something else. Because once I've put that fun thing into a scene that is moving the story forward, I've picked up the pace, I've made it more commercially paced, I've kept what I wanted, and I've kind of appeased the market at the same time.
Right.
And so that's kind of a trick that I've found, is to take the things that you love and the things that have to be there, and the more you can intertwine them, the more you're going to kind of make everyone happy.
Right. Right. I love that. I think that it's a lot of revision. I think a lot of revision. Yes. I think if you try and make it too commercial, you know, if you're trying to write it like too sellable in the first draft, it's going to kind of kill that, you know, that creative spurt that, like you said, that first draft is for you. And then that second draft is for, okay, how can I make this work? Like, how can I adapt to my audience? And I think that's a big thing, is thinking of who is your audience, and you should always be writing to that audience, especially on that revision.
Totally.
You know, this is for them. How do I, yes, this is for them, but it's wrapped in something that I'm super passionate about and I love, but the messages and everything else in there is for them, and the way they consume it is for them. So I need to make that as clear as possible. The other thing that I thought of was, actually, it was published today on Twitter. I'm going to say their initials, but you can find them as A.R. Friedrichsen on Twitter. Posted a thing that said, a query tip I wish I had been given earlier. You are selling a character, not a story, not a book, not a world, not a setting, not a concept, but a person, or several for that matter. That's what you're selling. And I think that holds a lot of merit, that you are, when you're writing your query letter, when you are writing this package, you, throughout the book, you are selling this character. And one thing that I've learned is that character kind of works, it really works in tandem with the world. I don't know. I listened to an episode of a podcast with V.E. Schwab where they talk about setting and how setting kind of informs the characters based on who is inside the world and who is outside the world.
Yeah.
And that's how I think you ultimately get to, this is about a character, and it's about a character's wants or needs. And I think that in and of itself, if you focus on that, is going to make your book commercial.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so too. And I think it's that's one of those kind of ironic things is that we think of like literary as being kind of this deep character analysis and commercial as being kind of plotty. But I think the most commercial books are the ones that have characters that feel completely real, like the kind of characters that you are so convinced they're real that you want to draw fan art or that you can imagine them showing up at your house one day. Yes. And so there's something to be learned from all of that. But it's when you can take that character that feels so three-dimensional and then also like keep the pacing moving or add tension.
Yes.
And I think one thing I love to do is I love to listen to podcasts that are sort of reader-centric. Uh-huh. You know, like there are lots of podcasts where it's like romance readers talk about books or, you know, like fantasy readers talk about books. And by just listening to readers who are not writers necessarily, it's a great reminder of like, oh, yeah, these things that a lot of times it's these things that I love, readers love that too. Like, why am I shying away from doing X, Y, Z? Because I think sometimes as writers, we think, oh, well, like that's been overdone. This has been overdone. And like there are things that have been overdone. But if there's a fun little tropey moment and you're having fun with it and you put it in your book, like worst case scenario, you cut it later. But try it and have fun with it.
Right.
Because if it's fun enough, you can make it feel fresh and you can make it feel different.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. These are good. Look at us go.
These are good questions.
Are you ready for our next question?
Sure.
How do you focus on a new project when your head is in the query trenches? And this is by Rhea on Instagram as well. Also, Rhea is one of the funniest people I know. So thank you for this question. So how do you focus on a new project when your head is in the query trenches?
Yeah. I don't think I had too much difficulty with this with my first two books that I queried, because by the time I queried them, I was so over it that I almost, like, what is it that Gwyneth Paltrow says? Like, conscious decoupled. Like, it was like, all right, go off into the world. I don't want to love you anymore because it's just going to hurt to watch you stumble. But I will admit, with this Vicious Grace, when I started querying that one, I think it was you I talked to that I was like, I am scared to query this because if this one doesn't work out, I don't think I can handle it. And I don't know how I would have done it at that point because I didn't have a new project. But I like to start thinking about a new project before I send the old one out. And then personally, I fiddle with line edits until I hate the sight of every word in the book. That helps me, but I don't know if that's a healthy strategy.
No, I mean, anything at this point is going to be a healthy strategy because we're struggling. I say we because I am there. I think you're right, having the project before. If I hadn't started this brainchild before Pitch Wars, I wanted it to be there in case it didn't get into Pitch Wars, that it would be my nano project. And then it would also be there after Pitch War, so I could just pick it back up again. That's made it a little easier. It's still been several, you know, it's been 2 months since Pitch Wars ended, and I haven't written a word of a chapter yet. I've just been outlining and kind of like falling back in love with writing.
Mm-hmm.
I guess for me, it's, as someone who is currently at the, if this book doesn't make it, I don't know what I'll do, and it's not going to make it. Like, it is, I think it is getting your heart in the right place with the other project and being okay with whatever happens with it enough that you can just kind of find joy in writing something new. I think now when you query, I think it's helpful for some people to be on the hustle of like, I got to write the next thing. That got me through the query process with the first two, or at least the part of it that I did. But I think right now I am off of the hustle aspect, especially when you're a querying writer, because so many people have said, like, and, you know, silly enough, like, enjoy that free, unfettered time to create, because it doesn't, once you do have an agent and have book deals, that time kind of shrinks and you don't have unlimited time to kind of play with a project. So I think take that unlimited time to have fun with characters and make playlists and make collages and make fan art and do whatever it is that is enjoyable for me. I just tried to seep myself into this world as much as possible and make it as exciting as possible so that whenever bad things happen with something else, I have something else that is very exciting for me. And I may not start writing it for another 2 months. Who knows? I don't know. But at least I'm having fun with these new people taking up space in my brain.
Yeah, I think that's really smart. And I think I was always someone that said, you know, start the next project so you fall in love with something else. And I support that. I don't think it's a blanket advice for everyone, but that worked for me. But at the same time, I, you know, queried basically nonstop for years on end. And that probably wasn't very good because at a certain point, it's like you said, it's a hustle. If you're hustling so hard that you forget to celebrate the fact that you finished writing a manuscript, like, you can't keep going like that forever. And even if you achieve the goal at the end of that, then you're going to have a crash and burn because at some point you have to stop. You have to refill your well. And yes. So, yeah, I think if you can get kind of the seed of an idea in your head so that you have something to focus on, but then also, like, let yourself watch a ton of movies. Like, make yourself a cake. Buy a cake. Be like, look at me. I am brave enough to send this book out into the query trenches, and now I get to read all those books on my TBR pile and watch a bunch of movies. And because you never know what's going to get you excited. And, you know, think of it as like running a marathon. Like, if a runner trains and runs a marathon and they finish the marathon, they're like, well, I didn't win the marathon, so I need to go run another one tomorrow. Like, that's not the way they're going to become their best self. You know, they need to stop and refuel and take a minute to look back and say, like, look what I did. Like, I did a great job there. And I think it may have been Cale Bird that talked about reading craft books, that he said that when he finishes something, he likes to take some time and read craft books for a while. And I think that can be great. I think anything that just – it's that transition, that liminal phase. Like, I think you need to let yourself have a liminal phase – a transition phase, an end of one thing and a start of a new thing, because it's a ritual in a way. Like, you've completed a thing, and I think as writers we tend to think, well, it's not completed because it hasn't got to the finish line or whatever. But again, like, even if you get an agent, even if you get a book deal, it's going to be years before that book is finished, is on a shelf. Right. So, like, if you don't mark each significant stage of the process, then there's never going to be a time where someone steps in and says, okay, now it's time to sit down and be happy and celebrate and refill that well. Right. So take those moments when you can, because it's good for your mental health.
I love that. I love that, because that is so true, that it is these start and stop times, right? Like, these markers of where you've been along the journey, where you started, where you're ending, that sort of thing. I think the one mistake I made was I didn't go into this with a set query list of, like, I'm going to query these agents and then be done. So there is no really ending point. Yeah. But for me, I have found – I find rules for myself to help kind of protect my mental health for something new. And those rules are I am not allowed to query before bed. It cannot be the last thing I do before laying down.
That is a good one. That's a good one.
Because I found I was a monster. Turn off
alerts. Turn off email alerts. That's my favorite one.
Like, I don't care. Turn those off. I can't send out queries because then I get frustrated with the whole system. And then I cry because, you know, got some rejections in there or whatever. Like, nothing's happening in my inbox. Another thing is that now that I don't have a set end list, I just query when I feel like it. So whenever I feel like throwing out a query or two, I'm going to throw out a query or two, and only when I'm feeling good. Mm-hmm. And then I can do it. And then that kind of, like, protects me during my other time. The other thing to help with making any rejections or anything like that hurt a little less, Kat Corby had a beautiful thing on her Instagram a couple of weeks ago about every 5 rejections, cold query rejections, do something nice for yourself, or get yourself something nice. So it can be like, if you don't go, like, you know, I don't get iced coffees out often. After every 5, I get a nice coffee. Yeah. Or every 5, I get a little flower bouquet for myself. And then every full request, do something a little bigger. And then every full rejection, do something a little bigger. So they're the same. They're the same, because you're celebrating the fact that you've put stuff out there and things have happened. So, you know, it's like, I got a full rejection. Guess what?
Girl, hey, someone read my whole book.
New yoga pants. Woo! Like, start that. And then I was talking to another friend on Twitter who had the same thing, where it's like little charms, right? They were buying little charms for their jewelry making business. And they were like, I'm going to get to buy this one and then make, like, this bracelet by the end, or whatever it is that they're going to make with it, because they're super crafty. And I think that that's really, really smart, having a little, like, fun system for yourself to celebrate it.
Yeah, and I think it's good to start these rituals and start kind of training yourself to celebrate the things that you've accomplished outside of exterior affirmations, because for better or worse in publishing, I think we all tend to look at the person – ahead of us and think, well, then it gets easy and then it's never bad. But like, that's never true. You know, like this is an artistic right. industry where like you're never going to win every reader. You're never going to get every good review. You're never going to get all the things you want because we are strivers by nature, because otherwise we wouldn't be trying to do this.
Yeah.
And so if you're always waiting for an outside pat on the head, then you'll always be waiting. So absolutely. Find ways to reward yourself because you still did the thing regardless of what happens
next. Yeah. Look at us go. All right, are you ready?
Writer therapy.
Yeah, I love it. Listen, so much about writing is self-care. Like, it's figuring out your own brain. It's psychology. It's
so much of it.
The more I do it, the more I'm like, this is weird.
Yeah.
Super secret question that I told you that I wouldn't tell you unless we actually did the Q&A episode. So here we go. Lauren Blackwood asks.
Hi, Lauren.
Why are you so cute?
Asked by the cutest person ever. I know. Thank I said, you, no, Lauren.
Why are you so cute? I was like, you're so cute. Love her.
Thank you, Lauren. I wonder if she still feels that way after today. I was in her DMs being like, this book hates me. This book's trying to kill me. And she's like, girl, are you still working on Act 3? I'm like, yes, I'm still working on Act 3.
If anybody has real advice for you, it's probably Lauren. Who's yeah. Like,
put that shit in your head. That's what you're doing. Seriously. Thank you, Lauren. Love you.
Yay, love you, Lauren. Next question. Thoughts on writing more than one point of view? And this is asked by, I close the document. This is asked by Jenny on Insta.
Yeah.
As someone who's doing two plus a weird, I'm doing two plus a little short story intervals in this next one.
Oh, nice.
Why?
How's that going?
You know,
you have more experience writing dual POV than I do. You do. So,
I've written out of all of my projects, I think I have like six projects. I've only written two as single POV.
Yeah, and you're really good at it too.
I try.
That's when the full-on panzer thing makes it harder.
Oh, gosh. That is... dual point of view is great.
Can be great.
It is great. I love it. Pros and cons. I think it's a wonderful, fun tool to telling a story. I think you need to read up on it pretty... you know, diligently. Yeah. Go see what other people think and other tips and tricks out there. Like, there's a handful of things, like, don't show the same event twice, you know, from different points of view, unless you're doing it artistically. Mm-hmm.
I would say make sure the difference between writing two points of view in first person and third person are significant in terms of whether you have to change by chapter or whether you can change by scene. You still can't change within a scene if you're writing close third, so be aware of that. I know because I am such a chaotic drafter, there are scenes in this sequel that I wrote and then I was like, oh no, I picked the wrong point of view. And so at certain points when I would send it to get feedback, I got feedback from Christy Smeltzer. Hi, Christy. My former writer teacher who kind of tactfully was like, question about point of view choices. And I was like, oh no. I need to get everything in the right spot and then I'm gonna revise. And she was like, oh good, okay, good. Right. There was some weird stuff happening and I was like, yeah, no, I know. The dreaded head hopping, you gotta be careful about that where you're not within a scene hopping around. But yeah, I think my first question to people is always, why do you want it to be dual point of view? And make sure that you have an answer for that. Because there are some times when dual point of view is essential or beneficial, and there are other times where it's not. Like, I feel very strongly that this Vicious Grace would not have worked as dual point of view.
No.
Because Dante's whole character, the way that I set him up, we needed to only see him from the outside. Right. We needed to not see him from inside his head. That would have nothing in the book would have worked if he had been able to convey things directly to the reader. So,
right.
You know, a lot of times I think people fall into the trap of trying to add points of view because there's stuff happening over there that these characters need to know about and the readers need to know about. And in general, I would say if your main characters cannot be there to know something, do they really need to know it? Or can it be summarized through someone else? If you're just adding points of view just to show stuff that's off scene, then there might be better ways to do that. But
right. I think there are obviously caveats to this. You know, if you're talking like high fantasy for adult, like adult high fantasy fiction, do whatever. Like, that's where you can artfully, Stephen King does it all the time, where like inside of a chapter, or even Robert Jordan does it. Mm-hmm. Stephen's reading the Robert Jordan series, the Wheel of Time series. And he was like, this will make people lose it. In the book he's reading, the prologue is 76 pages.
Oh my God.
And every other page or whatever changes points of view inside of the prologue. So he's like, there's people I've never even heard of that I'm hearing
blowing
from.
My mind so right now.
I think adult fantasy, adult horror, Stephen and King does it too. The rules. You go off. Go do
you can
your
break
thing.
Them once you learn them, but make sure you learn them. Yeah. You know, if you don't know what head hopping is, learn that before you try to write multiple
Which is totally
and...
different than head hopping. Like, head hopping is a totally different issue.
And omniscient is different than head hopping too, if you know what you're doing. It's just, if you don't know what you're doing and this is confusing to you, figure that out first, because otherwise you're going to have a lot of free writing to do later.
I think you're right. Ask why you need this second point of view or third point of view. Why do you need that?
Yeah.
The other thing, especially if you're writing young adult literature, I think it's imperative that the character itself has an arc. They have to have an arc. You know, it's one of those have to have. I don't like to say like, these are things that you have to do. But, you know, it's very important that that character does have an arc, that they start with a lie that they tell themselves and then they have to go through a change or whatever. And then again, just ask why, and then how do those pieces fit together?
I talk about this book all the time, but Victoria Schwab's The Savage Song was like a life-changing one for me. One, because it was the first time I read close third that I understood for the first time how close third can be just as close as first, if not closer at times. And also that book is like my holy grail example of using dual point of view thematically. Like, the whole theme of the book is like the girl who wants to be a monster and the monster who wants to be a human, and it just the way like every step of the way these characters are used so effectively to play off each other, and it's just, I mean, it like mind-blowing to me. My dream is to write a book that pulls that off as beautifully as that book does. But I think there are times where dual point of view is so great, because sometimes you want to be able to show how two characters see each other versus how they see themselves. Sometimes you want to show, you know, how their lives are intertwining, how they're changing each other in ways. But it is an additional challenge, especially if you're not someone who plans out everything ahead of time. Be prepared for the extra revision time that it's going to take to sort that out.
You
later.
Said that earlier. It's, I think, even if you plan it, even if you plan beforehand, because I've done that with a couple books where it's like, I planned it and it's going to be great and whatever. Being flexible, like, do not get it set in your, like, you can, it can become a darling that it has to be from this person's point of view, but just be flexible to the order, the POV, where it goes, why it's there, why does it belong to this person.
Right now.
Be so flexible.
Yes, I have color-coded. I basically printed out my entire Act 3 in size 5 font and chopped it up into little pieces, and I color-coded by point of view, and I'm moving stuff around. But I'm ending up with things where I have, like, a chapter that's, like, 200 words, one point of view, and 200 words. I'm like, this is not working.
Right.
But yeah, so there, that's a very good way of looking at it. Because things like what I was talking about earlier, where if I take bits of dialogue and put them into different scenes, I tend to write my dialogue with dialogue tags. And when you're doing dialogue tags in close third from a point of view, it's clear whose point of view it is. And so then you take that snippet of dialogue and you move it into a different scene that suddenly is the other person's point of view, and you have to rewrite all the dialogue tags. And so it's just a... Yeah, I know some writers do the thing where they just write the dialogue without any tags. And
that's what I do.
That if you can pull that off, that's great, because that makes it a lot easier to choose point of view later. But I have a hard time with it, because I think when I'm writing dialogue, I am so invested in whose point of view it is and how that changes the way that the dialogue is said and interpreted. But
we've talked about it before that I use like stage directions inside of mine. So it's like I can give a beat. Like, if they take a beat in between the line, I can explain inside the tag mentally why they are taking a beat. So if it's like they're taking a beat to remember their long lost life when their favorite cow ran away from the farm, you know, whatever it may be, and then move on. So then I can shift it later and be like, okay, I don't actually need this. They just need to know it's a beat.
Not so smart. Yeah. But yeah, it can be great and it can be terrible. Yeah. Just like all things in writing.
read up on some stuff. If I remember it, if I can hold on to it in my brain long enough, I will post some resources, but that's about all I got.
Yeah.
Right. Last question.
All right.
Are you ready? Jenny asked another one, so we're going to answer it very politely. Mm-hmm. Did you plan your series in advance, or if you planned each book at a time? And we can do this as like, should you or shouldn't you?
Yeah.
It can also be a question straight for you, Emily, however you want to handle this. So planning a series in advance or planning it one at a time.
So the wisdom in publishing is don't write a sequel until you've sold book one. And there are reasons for this. The first one is it takes a long time to write a book. And if you don't know if you're going to sell book one and then you spend 2 years writing book two and then you don't sell book one, that 2 years was, quote unquote, wasted, although it never really wasted. But I will say from personal experience, it is a rough fall off the cliff when you have told yourself you are not going to think too hard about a sequel and then suddenly you have been paid for a sequel and you've never let yourself write a sequel before. So in my case, at least, I told some of this before, but the short version is that book one was supposed to be a standalone and I was really torn on how to end it. And I had some ideas and then Margie Fustin yelled at me about my ideas and told me I could not do my ideas because she would hate me forever. And she came up with a solution that part of her pitch for her solution was, hey, look at this. If we do this, then it sets you up for a duology. And it was a really good idea. And it worked really well at the end of the book. And it allowed me to do what I was trying to do while also opening it up for a sequel. And so when we went on submission, or before we went on submission, my agent specifically said, if we want to try and sell this as a duology, you have to make sure, one, that you've earned it, that there is enough going on at the end of this book to warrant a second book. And two, as soon as we went on submission, she said, all right, now start working on a synopsis for that, you know, sequel, because if someone is interested in it, they're going to want to see it. I did make the mistake of assuming that sub would take a really long time, and so I didn't have to worry about that right away, which was not a great call, because then I had to write it very quickly, like very quickly. And I'm kind of the mind of, like, if you're writing a book and you have any hope of or any plans or thoughts of selling it as more than one book, do as much as you can to think about the arc of the characters, the arc of the story, and how much book you think that will take. Not how many books you want to write. How many books will it take? Ideally, the fewest number of books it will take to tell the story that you want to tell. And the more you can get down in terms of, you know, planning and plotting and beats, like, that is super helpful, but don't necessarily sit down and try to write that whole book, or at least try to write it perfectly and revise it, unless you have a good feeling that book one is going to go somewhere.
I think if we're looking at querying, I think there's a big push to have, like, it's a standalone with series potential, right? Mm-hmm. Like, that's the big thing. It's a standalone with series potential. And what that means is by the end of it, you can work in a little hook and it'll be okay. Because I have some advice that I'm like, do I want my name attached? Okay, here's the thing. If an agent gets all the way through your book and they get to the ending where you kind of have like a little hook for a second book and that's the only thing they don't like about your book, they're going to still offer. They're going to still offer. It's okay. They're going to work on it with you.
But if your book ends on a cliffhanger, what you're doing is you're asking that agent – you're suddenly asking that agent to try to tell two books instead of one, which is harder. You're asking an editor to try to get, you know, twice the money in investment. So, like, with mine, honestly, even when we went on submission, if we had only gotten offers for one book, then I would have changed the – I would have taken out the thing at the end that opened it up for a book two, and we would have sold it as a one book.
Exactly.
And I still don't know how I would have ended it.
I think it's – no. I totally get you. I think it's super smart to write it as generally as possible at the end, opening it up to a second or a third or whatever, just generally opening up. If the story closes out, it's done. That story is told. Like, if you read any of these big series, like, pick up a big series book, it ends. It closes. Mm-hmm. But there's always that little, like, the bad guy lurking in the back corner. And yeah. It's like, oh, that's the big bad guy. We just defeated one. Like, it's that kind of thing where you're like, oh, yeah. Sequel. But you're satisfied enough that if a sequel never happened, you're good. Yeah. And then, like you said, I think what you're suggesting to me sounds like almost like get a submission package going for this next book. So write the query letter, get the pitch down, write a very quick, very brief, not totally filled out synopsis.
Yeah. Make sure you can justify. If someone says, what are you going to do in book two? Why do you need book two? You should be able to be like, oh, look at this cool stuff that I have planned.
Yes.
Yeah. Because if you're just like, I just want to write two books. Well, that's not going to convince the reader to read two books. And I would also say pay attention to your genre and your age category and ask yourself, what else is happening in that category right now? Because like the days of six book series in YA fantasy are... We're not in that day right now.
Yeah.
So if your plan is to write six books, you're going to have the best-selling book one in the history of ever. So, like, just keep that in mind. And again, there's a big difference between a series and a duology or a series and a trilogy. Those are different. Like, I often have people tell me, well, is there going to be a book three? And I say, no. And they say, well, you never know. And I say, yeah, I do.
Right.
I am writing it. To end it at two. That doesn't mean that there couldn't be something in the same world, but this is a self-contained unit. I, as the author, am deciding how it is going to end, how I'm wrapping it up in a way that, for me, if I tried to tack on a third book, it would feel like I had tacked it on. And so, you know, just pay attention to what's out there. You know, leave yourself doorways if you want the possibility of writing, you know, things in the same world or other, you know, books that overlap or are complementary or that kind of thing.
Right.
But just if you send a query letter to an agent saying this is the first book in a six book series, that's going to make them a little twitchy because that's just asking a lot of them. So,
no, I totally agree. I was looking at my bookshelf to think of books that do. I was thinking of, I'm on a V.E. Schwab kick today.
As we all should be all days.
Every day. That's not anything normal, not anything unusual, I guess. But she does a really great job of she never writes a cliffhanger. And she wrote her first cliffhanger inside the Shades of Magic series. And it was the second book. And I remember being like
confused,
floored. I was like, what is this? I need the third one. But that's a totally different thing because one, she's an established author at that point. Two, she knows she's getting a trilogy. So she's got to set up this whole big arc, right? But if you read any of her books, like her villain series, you can read that and each book stands by itself, but then shows character exploration through the two or three that she has, right? So
I will say my oldest child just finished the fifth Arusha book, and for about a week straight, all I heard was, I need there to be another one. And I was like, well, there might be, because, you know, my daughter's going, but I don't know what happened to this character. I need to know what happened to this character. And I was like, okay, well, if you need to know what happened to that character, that sounds to me that, like, the author left it open. And she keeps holding up the book going, it says last book in the series. And I was like, okay. What you're telling me is that the publisher says this is the last book in the series, but you as the reader are saying, no, there's more to be told here, which means to me, this author has left a doorway open. Whether there could be a spinoff, whether there could be something else, it may not be purchased yet, but she as a reader senses that there is something else that needs to happen. It's not just I love this book so much that I want more, it's, but I want to know what happened with this person. I still don't understand what happened here.
Right.
And to me, again, and I do not know, this is just my interpretation of a child's interpretation of a book. I thought, okay, that's an author that did a masterful job of wrapping up a series and leaving a big old, like, hand out to the publisher. Hey, would you like some more? Because my readers are going to want more, too. So
that
is probably an example of how to do it well. Again, I have not read them yet, but according to my child, knocked it out of the park. So.
Love it. I love that series. I recommend it all the time at the library.
Yeah.
It's so good. I think that's all I got for
nice
series and stuff. Just try and wrap it up as much as you can.
Yeah.
Woo! We answered a bunch of questions. Look at us go for our first Q&A.
It's nice to feel like I've done something.
Yay!
staring at the same scenes and moving around and moving around and moving around and moving around. And they never go anywhere. It's nice to just sit down and like answer a question and be like, yay, check, check, check.
We did that. We answered so many questions.
Yay.
As always, if you want to ask questions, you can always go to our Instagram. You can go to our Twitter. Forgive me. I just burped.
We're classy operation here.
Classy. Okay, anyway, you can go to our Instagram, you can go to our Twitter, you can also leave, if you go to our Anchor website, which I put on Instagram, you can leave us a voice question. We've only had one of those, and it was amazing, so go leave us a little voice question.
Number two, kids.
Come on!
Swoop on in there.
I really want to be that podcast. It's like, we have a reader's, a listener submission, and here's their clip. Boop! And then you hear other people. I think that would be really cool. So
yeah, that would be cool.
I will put that on Instagram. I will also send it to you to put on Twitter, and it'll be great.
Totally.
Emily, great. This has been fun. What, Emily, is something this week or past couple of weeks that has brought you joy, has made your life better in some capacity?
I went to a beach.
Yay!
We'll say that one. Yes, I had my laptop. My plan was to send the thing before I went, and I did not do that. But at least I got to write in a new location, which is a delightful change of pace.
How exciting. Yes. That's a big, like, fun thing.
Yeah, it was really nice. How about you? What has brought you joy recently?
I started exercising again because I'd fallen off that. So. Yeah. Trying that. My little body is weak and feeble.
Get those endorphins.
Getting those. Man, isn't it funny how you're like, I should do this.
Uh-huh. And then you do it and you're like, exercise. All right. It does work.
I feel awesome. Damn it.
Every time I take a walk, I'm like, every time I'm like, you should take a walk, you'll feel better. I don't want to. Then I take a walk and I'm like, oh yeah, that does actually work. Does that is a real thing. Work. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, other thing, because it's big right now, and everybody will know when they listen to this. Our flag means death has brought me the most joy.
I've heard this in my life. We don't have the channel, so
freak
I need to
on a leash. It
I
is
need to start
so
a campaign.
Good. It is so like I love media that is just gentle media. Mm-hmm. So like it cuts deep at some points, but every episode is like just about not being a jerk and being the best version of yourself. And we had such a good time. Like I want a
so
pair
excited.
Of shorts that says, check out this fabulous booty I'm hawking. Like I want shorts that say that. I want it so badly.
I'm probably going to get there like a year late, just like I did
it's
with
okay.
Ted Lasso. Like
I
I'm always
Ted Lasso.
A year late. Yeah.
Okay.
Wait till the next season and then I'll binge
that's
all
what
at
I
once.
Did. That's
but,
what we
yeah.
did. We waited until season two was finished and then we were like, okay, now we can watch it. And then we saw
it. I'll save it up. Maybe that'll be my like reward to myself when this book hits shelves and I need to run away from social media.
Do
for a while.
It. It's 10 episodes, half an hour each. It
sounds
is
delightful.
I mean, it's one of those like beautifully, you know, when somebody's like gay pirates, I'm like, man, I watch Supernatural. They say gay everything and then nothing was gay. And this is
and this
gay
one, they,
pirates.
They, gay pirates. That's, yeah. I'm like, I don't know anything about the show except for, like, everybody loves it. Gay pirates. And I'm like, that's sounds
Taika
fantastic.
Taika Waititi is a sexuality that I didn't know I had.
Yeah. I've heard that from a lot of people.
I mean, it's him in that black beard getup that I was like, oh, no. Where did this come from? Like, I've always admired him, and he's very funny, and, like, he's attractive. But I
Have
was like,
Have you ever
oh.
seen the pictures of him snuggling on the set of
yes!
the
– Yes! That's my pitch. That's my pitch to everyone about the show. I'm like, do you remember that picture of him snuggling Chris Hemsworth and –
Chris
oh,
Evans,
I lost his
it?
Name. Yes.
Yeah.
Loki.
It was like a Chris sandwich. Wasn't he a Chris sandwich?
No, it was Chris Hemsworth and it was Loki. It was
Tom Hiddleston.
It was the three
I
of
I feel
them.
Like there might be more than one picture. I think he had a reputation for like group snuggles
well,
on the set of all these
if there's a series of them, it's literally the comp title to this Our Flag Means Death. Like it's literally, I told Steven, I was like, do you remember that picture? And he's like, oh my God, that's what the show is. And I was like, exactly.
I love it. There you go, people. Write the thing that you get excited about and you can find a way to make it commercial.
If we're going to go back to commercial stuff, like, look at this. Somebody pitched this and they would have been like, what?
What? Yep.
But it works because
that's
it's
the stuff
comedy.
It does.
It's, I don't know, it's just so good. Anyway, it brought me a smile of joy. Very
wonderful. I love that smile.
Okay. It makes me so excited. I love that just. Thanks for listening to another episode of Basic Pitches. We super appreciate it. As I said in the podcast, you can find us on Twitter, Instagram, and on Anchor, where you can send us questions. We love hearing from you. I will make sure to link all of that in the show notes, and I will see you next time.